Welcome to Automates, the podcast that brings you musings from thought leaders and industry pioneers who are shaping the way we work, think, and succeed. Each episode is packed with insights, expert interviews, and practical tips that will inspire and empower you to take your business to the next level. So tune in, subscribe, and get ready to innovate with Automates. So, Stuart Barr, welcome to Automates, our new little podcast. So you're one of our first guests, so welcome. Hello.
Thank you very much. Good to be here. One of the first or the first?
Well, it's one of the first recordings. I don't know what order you'll actually come out in, but it's fine.
So we'll the publish order could be different.
See what the quality's like. We'll just
Fair enough.
See what we want to do. So, you and I, we've known each other for far too long, but why don't you sort of tell the audience a little bit about yourself, where you come from, what you do, what gets you up in the morning, and then we'll crack into some juicy stuff.
That's quite a broad question. Where do I come from? I mean, you know, I'm obviously from Great Britain, England specifically. And yeah, I mean, we know each other from Haikyuu, clearly. And I think that's where, you know, anyone that's listening to this podcast would most likely know me from Haikyuu. You know, I was the chief product and strategy officer there for nearly 12 years, I think, from 2009. Prior to that, I worked at, I got into the legal sector at Freshfields prior to working at Haikyuu, which is where I met the founders of Haikyuu and kind of got involved in that. And before that, professional services and sort of consulting around technology and social computing and stuff like that. So that's kind of, you know, my career background, if you like. What gets me up in the morning? I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, a challenge. I like a good challenge, Ben. You know, managing you is always a challenge. Well, yeah. So these days, it's a bit different to what gets me up. Obviously, I'm no longer at Haikyuu and haven't been for the last sort of 3 years. So now I sit on the board of a couple of different companies. I do consulting and some mentoring for a variety of different organizations and CEOs and founders and so on. Plus, have a bit more free time than I used to do some things in my personal life, like golf for my sins, which is probably the worst decision I've ever made, taking up golf. It's the most frustrating thing ever. And playing the drums. I've taken up playing the drums as well, which is really cool. Both of which are very challenging and at times very frustrating. So I like to blend those kind of personal challenges with business challenges of advising companies, helping them grow, actually trying to, you know, really use the many mistakes we made at Haikyuu over the years and some of the good things we did at Haikyuu to help other people to be successful. You know, that's, you know, on a kind of work basis, that's what's kind of getting me up in the morning these days.
Yeah, it sounds really cool. And it's really varied. I think that's one of the things I enjoy sort of. I wasn't as clever, smart, or early as you guys in terms of Haikyuu, but I chat to people, maybe not as much, who are starting up or coming out of sort of ventures and stuff, and looking at, okay, well, what did we do wrong? What can we do? The perception was that we were really successful, and maybe something we touch on a little bit later, but sort of, you make mistakes and you get through those things, and you sort of see where you get to. And I think that's the opportunity to mentor, as you say, is really valuable.
Yeah, I mean, you learn far more from making mistakes than you do from being successful. Weirdly, I saw a YouTube video the other day where Ed Sheeran was saying that, and he was showing a video of himself when he started out when he was like 14 and he was terrible, couldn't sing, couldn't do anything, and then 3 or 4 years later he was, you know, successful. But you know, as he said, you know, you learn a lot more from making mistakes. And you know, certainly, you know, over the period of being involved with Haikyuu, as I said, we made lots and lots of mistakes. But what I really enjoy is kind of trying to give some of that learning back to other people. And, you know, they're still going to make mistakes. It's not like I'm going to, you know, just because I'm talking to someone, prevent them from making mistakes. But hopefully you can advise them, set them on the right path, and, you know, help them to make better decisions and avoid some of the pitfalls and the stupid things that I've done and that we've done over the years.
And I think, that, I mean, that said, to for me personally, we've sort of coming into Autologix and starting to look at how we do stuff and how we scale and what that means, sort of, we might have attempted to do things 3 times at Haikyuu to get to the end goal of where we were. Ultimately, I can sort of fast track myself through those three jumps and adapt yeah. for where I am and what I'm doing. So yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
And it's so valuable. I mean, you saw and were part of many of the experiences that we had at Haikyuu. But you know, back then when we were going through them, we didn't know, and you don't know what you don't know. Yeah. And so, you know, I wish I had my kind of future self to advise me back then. You know, I could have avoided many, many things. So, you know, and I see the same in a lot of the founders that I speak to and people that I work with. You know, they haven't done it before. You know, I think everyone I work with is a first-time kind of founder or trying to go through the same process that we went through at Haikyuu. I really enjoy trying to kind of get involved in that and you know, help them on that journey to be hopefully really successful themselves.
Yeah, and I think it's what's really interesting, sort of when I look back at when I started in legal 22 years ago working for CMS, and sort of typically you had, I don't know, 25 vendors that you sort of used to deal with, and it's sort of they were the big guys and they're still around today and everything else. There are hundreds of vendors now. There are hundreds of startups yeah. doing really cool, interesting, innovative things. Ex-lawyers who had pain points that wanted to address a particular thing because there wasn't a piece of technology out there. So I think what's really interesting is that the ability to sort of drive forward with an idea, get some traction and take it forward. And sort of it goes against what I was sort of seeing sort of 6-7 years ago, which was like the platformization, which isn't even a word, of legal tech. Everyone was trying to go, right, we've got one platform that does everything, we're going to try and solve the world. Whereas now you look at everyone's just trying to create a little niche and try and solve one little problem. Mm. And then they try and solve bigger problems, but they're really coming at it from sort of lawyer workflows and trying to sort of solve for those things. And that's really...
But I think you know, platforms versus point solutions was always a big thing that we talked about, you know, in the Haikyuu days. But it's probably, as you just said, more of an issue now because there's so many more point solutions. There's so many more companies. You know, the problem that you have is point solutions are great at solving a problem, but they don't necessarily all work together very well. And you get a broken kind of experience when you start working across them. So I really think what everyone in the industry needs to do is just make sure that they are part of the ecosystem. Make sure they have open APIs, they work with each other, they have integrations, they're interoperable, and that they, you know, can be used together as part of a broader set of tools. I think that is really crucial. And then, you know, you can connect things together yourself if you need to. You know, if the vendors haven't done it, you can do it. Yeah. But I think that openness is really, really crucial, whether or not it's a platform or whether it's a point solution. You should be able to choose the toolkit you want and then assemble it in the way you need.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that whole ecosystem was one of the things that we always sort of strived towards at Haikyuu. But you sort of see more and more impact around being able to do that elegantly and really quickly. And I think sort of technology like sort of integrations and everything else nowadays, you've got applications like Zapier and all the others that sort of make it really, really simple and frictionless, because big B2B organizations, they don't want to have to spend a ton of money and a ton of time trying to get it set up and working. But whereas actually you start to think about, okay, what's the impact of joining somebody's point solution to the rest of the workflow or the rest of the outcome? And I think that's a big, big part of sort of the challenge. I think one of the things that I think is really interesting with the rise of the volume of point solutions, and having been on the buy side but not really sort of at this current moment, I can imagine it must be really difficult buying technology at the moment, because whereas you're trying, there's a conflict between sort of rationalization and reduction and procurement saying we don't need 100 vendors, and actually sort of the needs of the business within the practice saying actually we need this because it's going to save us 50% of our time, and actually nobody else does this, but we need 10 of them. And that's really tricky.
Have you talked about the
buying challenges and the things that might
come? Yeah, well, I see it in the companies that I work with. And, you know, it's definitely a more challenging environment, I would say, for the vendors now. But that's because it's a more challenging environment for the clients, right? Because there's so much more choice, but also there are huge, I was going to use the word distractions, I'm not sure if that's the right word, but you know, if you take Gen AI, for example, it's massively sent everyone off down a particular path, and everyone is like, Gen AI, we must do that, you know, and they feel like it's almost existential. And it, of course, everything else then, you know, gets put to the side as, you know, not as important. And I think the potential mistake there for the law firms is that they lose sight of more basic things, you know, low hanging fruit, which still need to be solved. You know, the Gen AI is great and it can do things and it's going to do more stuff in the future. And it can help firms be more efficient, et cetera, et cetera. But so can loads of other tools, you know, whether it's basic automation or workflows or collaboration or still just sharing files efficiently or communicating, collaborate. You know, there are still some really, really basic things that actually a lot of people individually, you know, as people that work in organizations, but organizations and teams don't do very well. You know, solving those sort of simplistic problems. And there's still so much manual stuff that happens in organizations, people repeating the same processes or reinventing processes, you know, not reporting back in real time to clients about progress, you know, whatever it is. There's a lot of low hanging fruit. And so, you know, I feel like as the technology landscape has got much more complicated and new technologies, more advanced stuff like AI has come along, it's just made it so much harder to get the right prioritization and the balance between complex, potentially game-changing stuff and day-to-day boring kind of hygiene factor stuff that you just need to do, which is basic, but actually still really, really important to get right.
Yeah, and I think it's been really interesting sort of seeing the dynamic of sort of, this is an oversimplification, but you sort of, you see law firms over the last 5 or 6 years, you've got your core IT doing some email, iManage, all of those kind of sort of key functions that you'd expect, keeping the lights on almost. And then you've got the rise of KM / innovation teams doing the practice acceleration and the sort of the operational side of things that sort of maybe a little bit more adventurous and risky. But I think what's really interesting now, probably over the last sort of 15 months, is that the budgets around innovation have been so consumed by Gen AI. It's not just the budgets, it's the time, it's the resource, it's the focus, as you say. And I think that's really challenging because BAU in a Gen AI is going to be the answer to everything. We know that. We look at the use cases that come out and we look at how people are using it and starting to think about using it. It's not going to solve everything, but ultimately you start to look at, okay, well, how can it be used? How can it be scaled? What does that look like? But then you come back to the core of, okay, well, it's a knowledge function. It's information architecture. It's understanding your data. It's understanding sort of what your processes are, not just providing a chat interface to go and chat to Bob or whatever you've called it.
I think it doesn't, like you say, it doesn't solve everything. And there's still lots of other stuff that needs to be done. I think, you know, what people are probably struggling with is how does that fit with everything else that needs to be done? What does it potentially replace or negate the need for? What do you need to complement Gen AI, et cetera, et cetera? But yeah, but that's the challenge in the industry at the moment. And I think it does make it hard for vendors. It's a very, very, very different industry and landscape now than, you know, for example, you know, 15 years ago when we were kind of at the start of the growth journey for HiQ. So, you know, it's, you know, when I sit on the board of a few different companies and, you know, I see those challenges every day, but there's still lots to be done. There's still, you know, interesting. I've been quite pleased to see recently a great reactions to some of the more simplistic tools that you know, I'm involved with, which still just solve a problem. They're good old fashioned. You have a problem, we have a solution. Great. Let's implement it and get some good value from it. And I think it's even more important now for people to be able to kind of articulate the value proposition of what they're selling and focus on solving real world pain points, you know, rather than perhaps grander, longer term visions. I think it's more important to be a bit more grounded these days.
Yeah, I think so. You mentioned something about sort of one of the gaps or challenges around sort of repeatability, templates, process automation on that side of things. Obviously, I want to talk about it because that's sort of this world that we live in. But I'm going to come at it from a slightly different direction. One of the things that we've seen over the years is not just from an Autologics perspective, but the idea that process and productivity gains and efficiency gains are all talked about, but it's really hard to drive that kind of change and adoption of these kinds of technologies because you're, as you said, sort of you've got one process for one thing and then you're going to reinvent it for the same thing, but just because it's a partner that sits around the corner. And how do you, I can talk to what we see, but how do you see the challenges? Because I don't think that challenge around adoption, around sort of that process engineering kind of world, it's a real world kind of thing because people don't like to be told how to work, if that makes sense. So how do you see the adoption of those kinds of things rolling through?
I've always said the technology is the easy part, to be honest. Actually, relatively speaking, it's quite easy to build a product that does something, right? Hire a bunch of engineers and build something. I'm oversimplifying it clearly and underplaying maybe my own career there. But once you've built the product, actually, that's when the hard work begins because, you know, as sort of I was saying earlier on, first of all, you've got to convince people that they need it, right? And that you know, that they should implement it to solve some kind of problem. But then you've actually got to implement it and maybe, depending on what it is that you're selling, change the way people work. And it's, you know, I think it's the cultural inertia within organizations that is the biggest barrier to that. They don't want to change. Most organizations would rather stay in the same state that they are in, you know, and preserve the status quo than adapt, transform, change into something else. And that's just the way of the world. And we're all like that. None of us really like, once we get settled into a routine and we're doing something, we know how to do it and it works for us, it's like, well, why change it? You know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it type thing. But of course, you know, there are potential huge gains to be made if you can change the way you work and, you know, automation, repeatability, you know, visibility of information, transparency, communication. There's so many aspects to these things that can be massive improvements. But it's the people side of it that is the most difficult. And, you know, for a software company like Autologics or, you know, HiQ is the same, and Legatics and Syncly that I'm involved with, for those guys, customer success and the onboarding process and then the guidance through the implementation of the software and then the ongoing kind of investment that you need to make in your customers so that they are, you know, Ben, when we were doing it, I used to talk about education and enablement. I mean, that is essentially what you have to do constantly. Yeah. You're constantly trying to educate your customers on what you do, what they can potentially implement, what problems they could potentially solve. But then you've got to try and enable them to actually do it. And sometimes that's not easy because, you know, you can't do all that yourselves as a vendor. You have to have a team of people effectively in the customer that does it. And so I've seen over the years massive variance in customers that are able to make use of technology. Mostly, I would say it comes down to, you know, how much resource they have available to themselves internally, as well as that cultural desire to drive change. And if they have a great team, it doesn't have to be a fancy innovation team or, you know, it doesn't have to be a sophisticated team necessarily, but it does need to be someone who takes ownership and is the advocate for it, who then can help implement it, will put the time, and the effort internally to communicate it and then run a program of change. So a lot of it comes back to good old fashioned change management at the end of the day.
Yeah. I mean, I'd sort of, I can't remember whether it was a blog post or an article or something on LinkedIn, but I sort of wrote something where we have that real challenge with what we do is process re-engineering, process orchestration, workflow automation, the whole kit and caboodle. So you're bringing humans into parts of a process, but you're letting the technology, which is really sort of just it's doing the rest of it, and sort of you've got to build up that trust and understand it. But I started talking about software with a service in the sense that customer success, as we used to describe it at HiQ, which I think has changed now, but ultimately we did focus in on the enablement. We became trusted sort of partners as such. It wasn't a chargeable service. It was something that we did on top of selling the actual license, really. And that evolved over time, and it was one of those things. But I think that idea that when you're only going to be as successful with the technology play as well as you become part of that sort of core team and what you're doing and how you do it. So that idea of software with a service is, I mean, it's not a new thing, but there aren't typically you don't really consider it as a startup. And when you're looking at things, you think about, okay, what costs have I got? Well, I've got sort of, I've got engineers and I've got hosting and I've got this and I've got sort of, but actually the time and effort that you put into an onboarding program and a customer experience program and then ongoing support, enablement and education, I think it's massively understated in organizations of our size. It's almost a given. Yeah, we'll get it in there and we'll sort it out. But actually, I think the as you scale and as you become more sort of focused on it, not focused on it, but focused on scaling, it's the go-to-market. It's the sales. Can we increase our headcount in sales? Can we do more marketing? Can we do this? Whereas actually, I think there's an equal, whilst it doesn't return the same revenue, it creates stickiness and it creates that kind of experience where people want to partner with you and want to grow with you.
Well, I think in a way, you know, we're talking very much about scaling software companies here, but in a way, it's probably one of the biggest challenges, I think, is how do you scale customer success? Because actually, when you're a small company and you've got a small number of customers, you can invest quite heavily in those customers. I mean, I remember in the early days of HiQ, you know, we would literally bend over backwards for any customer, really anything they wanted. And, you know, literally, you know, you had AJ or Vinay or myself or whatever, literally dealing with support tickets ourselves personally and seeing things through to conclusion, making sure it was all sorted. As you scale, that becomes completely untenable. You can't have the CEO or the, you know, whoever doing that kind of work. So how do you scale that experience and evolve it, you know, to what your customers need as they change and the way that your software changes and the way that you implement it changes? You know, certainly that was a huge point of learning. And as you know, we went through multiple different iterations of that at HiQ and how, you know, we would approach trying to solve for that. Yeah. And at different times we had maybe a different emphasis on driving revenue versus success in inverted commas, which of course ultimately leads to revenue. And the way we set up the team and the types of people that we used in those roles, you know, are they product experts? Are they deep kind of domain experts or are they more account managers? You know, there's so many different aspects to it. But even then, even when you've got that sorted, how do you scale that? So you can maybe go from a 10 customers to a few hundred customers, but how do you take that model to thousands of customers, like a really high touch model? Then you have to kind of try and digitize your customer success, try and get it into, you know, those are the sorts of challenges we started to, you know, started to kind of look at just as we got, you know, acquired by Thomson Reuters. That was the next phase on the journey that we never had to kind of go through effectively. But, you know, that is the big challenge. How do you scale that high touch, you know, feeling that you, you know, are really close to your customers and you're very attentive and you're really helping them? How do you scale that out to hundreds or thousands of customers? Very difficult to do.
Yeah, 100%. And I think one of the things that we're looking at internally here, not that it's important, but it's just sort of interesting, we're trying to see how we accelerate those decision points of when we start to introduce digital versus high touch or the blend or what the mix looks like and how do we adapt and what does that look like so that we're sort of front running some of those kinds of decisions. Probably 8 years ago, 7 years ago, 6 years ago, it was tricky to sort of bring all of that together at the scale we were without real concerted effort. And if I can get ahead of it now, that's what we're trying to do, if that makes sense. So it won't be right and it won't be perfect, but it'll be that sort of start on that journey rather than forcing ourselves to do it because we need to do it because we can't do what we want to do, which is that high touch kind of experience. Cool. I mean, I think one of the things that sort of we sort of sit in the whole sort of process world, and I think we had this at HiQ, but it's sort of our platform, Autologix, is a generic set of capabilities. It's not like a point solution as we've been talking about. It can do a number of different things for a number of different types of companies in a number of different verticals. How do you see sort of the when we talk about process orchestration, so the end-to-end process sort of mapping, coordination and delivery of a work type. So contract remediation is a hot topic for us. We've got three or four customers that are building out service lines on our technology that are looking at how do they do this for the 20 projects that they get from the 20 largest organizations that they work with, and how do they break that challenge of everything's slightly different and everyone wants to work differently. But ultimately, there is a driver with the rise of alternative service providers and everything else. That's their route to market, standardization, playbooks. How do you see the journey with all the distractions of Gen AI and everything else? How do you see the journey that law firms perhaps need to go on to encourage that? Is there a new thing that needs to happen? Is there a business line that they need to approach? Is it just the type of customers that they're working with? How do you see, if a firm wants to adapt and drive in that direction, what do they need to think about?
Well, I mean, for a start, I think there's always going to be, you know, a mixture of work that firms have to deal with. You're going to get your kind of bet the business type bespoke kind of stuff, which is never going to be, you know, automated. And then, you know, at the other end of the spectrum, you get your, you know, kind of very repeatable processes, which are just, you know, doing the same thing over and over again, usually at scale. Clearly, you know, what you're talking about is more on the, you know, the second end of that spectrum. I mean, it's really difficult because, as I said earlier, there's that cultural inertia that's involved, the people side of it. But I think, you know, on the technology, first of all, you've got to have the right toolkit in place because, you know, I don't think there is a single piece of software that will enable you to solve all of your legal process problems, right? So you're going to have a combination of software tools. As I mentioned earlier, I think it's critical in the industry now, ever more critical for your software tools to be, you know, interoperable, part of the legal tech ecosystem, you know, with open APIs and integration so that they can be used together. And then for platforms like AutoLogix and, you know, Syncly, you know, hands up, a company I've invested in, better disclose that one straight away, to kind of act as the glue that, you know, connect these platforms and point solutions for you to help drive those processes through, even though you're using multiple different solutions. Actually, you know, AutoLogix and other products can help automate those processes and connect them together and act as that glue. So whilst you won't necessarily have a platform provided by a single vendor, stuff like AutoLogix can help solve that problem and act as the kind of the intermediary between different systems. But it does depend on those systems being open and AutoLogix being able then to integrate with them and, you know, automate things within them. For us at HighQ, whilst we were building a platform, we also were very aware of the fact that we needed to build, you know, an open platform, one that other people could integrate with and that we could integrate with other people and be part of an ecosystem. And for us, that was extremely important. So even if, you know, other vendors out there that might be listening, that if they're building platforms, you've still got to be open and you've still got to integrate with other platforms and other point solutions. And then, you know, players like AutoLogix can come in and fill the gaps and be that glue that connects stuff together.
Yeah, and that makes sense. And I think all of that leads into sort of one of the things that I was thinking about as I was preparing my brain for this chat, which was I cast my mind back. So you did, when we were, like, this was 7-8 years ago, you did a webinar, and I can't remember who it was. I think it was with Ron Friedman and a couple of others, where you talked about law as a team sport. And so the rise of sort of experienced professionals that support the legal teams to go and deliver solutions, to build things, to sort of...
And legal engineers, rise of the legal engineer was a blog post I wrote back in, 2015 or something.
Yeah. And it's something that you talked about earlier, sort of the technology side of things, sort of easy. It's not obviously easy, but it's sort of easy. But it's how do you bring together the right people at the right time to provide the right kind of input to make the right kind of outcomes? And I think that I've seen that rise, but I don't know if I've seen that rise as much as I would have expected it to. So sort of when I talk to prospects and customers, and I'm talking to different teams, and I'm trying to work out, okay, well, what does you're delivering a particular work type doing a thing. Who's got input? and how much of that input is sort of secondary, i.e. you're asking for a service of IT or you're asking marketing to do something, whereas how much are you bringing a team together to do that? And I think that's really interesting. I think the firms that get that bit right and understand that people with different backgrounds, different experiences and different sort of education levels and degrees and not, that is really the key. That's a driver. It comes back to the human side of things. So bringing the right team together makes the fact that technology is easy or a commodity, but actually you're solving with the right people on the queue as such.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, you've got to have people with a mixture of skills. Clearly, you know, lawyers are typically focused on being amazing lawyers. And sometimes when they stop focusing on that and they want to go and do other things, they can actually be, you know, really valuable in other roles and apply their skills and to solving other problems. But as they're, when they're practicing, that's what, you know, that's what they need to be focused on. And I'm sure that's what they are focused on. I think for me, you've got to have technologists or people that really deeply understand technology, almost like, you know, what I've seen an increase in, you know, product managers almost. I mean, that's what law firms actually call some of these people inside their firms now. They're not product managers in the way that I think of product managers, because they're not really building products and managing the features that are developed in those. In some cases they are, if they're doing their own internal development. But actually what they're really doing is literally managing a product that they have bought, you know, and is provided by another vendor. And I think that's a crucial role, because you need to have someone who kind of has ownership and responsibility and kind of drives it into the organization. So I think that's one role that's crucial. I think then people that, and this could be where someone who perhaps is a, you know, an ex-practicing lawyer comes in, you've got to have people who are focused on process improvement as well. So you've got to understand the product, but then you've got to understand the process that you're trying to improve. And that requires usually quite deep knowledge and maybe personal experience and pain of having gone through that, you know, that process previously when practicing perhaps. So that's a good combination. You know, someone who, you know, probably was practicing and now kind of looks at it and thinks, God, you know, we could do so much better, because they're looking at it now externally rather than being in the process. I don't think you can't really solve a problem if you're deeply in it, because you're too engaged in getting your work done. But once you come out and you can look at it externally, you can start identifying with the problems, the weaknesses, the easy areas for improvement. And when you combine those people with, you know, technology experts, you know, product process kind of experts, even kind of project management expertise, I think that's a powerful combination. And I think really that is the definition of what I talked about all those years ago when I started talking about legal engineers. They are people with a combination of legal kind of process knowledge and sort of technology product expertise. And when you put them together, whether that's one person or it's two people working closely together, it's extremely powerful. And I think you know, the need for that is probably more so now than it was, you know, 10 or so years ago, with the complexity of the technology that we've talked about, and the, you know, the ever more, you know, all the different options you have now to solve problems. You could probably solve the same problem in 100 different ways now.
Yeah.
So I think
I was just,
go on.
I was just going to say, and I think I was just going to layer on, I think one of the things that I've seen, and I was going to ask your thoughts on it, is sort of that blended kind of product ownership, product manager slash sort of process, but been at the coalface, understanding the legal processes. I think there's an additional complexity now with the whole Gen AI stuff and everything else, which is a lot of that is deeply technical. It's like, okay, we need to do RAG, we need to do vector embedding, we need to do this, we need to do that. And sort of, I think there's a new level of technical requirement that doesn't necessarily sit inside of core IT, but can do, but doesn't sit inside of the innovation KM teams, because it's more technical. And I think there is a rise of that kind of need for that kind of experience, because obviously everyone's running around like headless chickens trying to chase the Gen AI dream, but it's very difficult, which is why you sort of see productized versions being sort of adopted so quickly and easily. But I think, what do you think around the need for that level of proper understanding of that kind of technology, and where would you?
It's an interesting question, isn't it? And I think You know, for me, I've always had, you know, I clearly would have come, you know, coming at it from my perspective, but I've always had a bit of a problem with law firms trying to be software companies, right? You know, it's never made a lot of sense to me, you know, when there are products out there that you can take off the shelf. Okay, maybe it takes some implementation effort and tweaking, or maybe even working with the vendor to build the exact solution that you need. So I would counsel against law firms trying to get too deeply technical. I think the solution market will come to them eventually, at least. And I think with any new solution, there'll be this initial scramble to try and, you know, come up with solutions. And because the vendors haven't yet caught up with that need, there's a bit of a lag probably and an interim period where the most innovative firms will invest in the technology and their own, you know, their own kind of solutions. Ultimately, I think that will get leapfrogged and overtaken and effectively productized and commoditized. Yeah. So we're probably in that interim stage at the moment where the most innovative firms are wanting to do it quicker than the market is providing solutions for. And so they're having to invest more in those technical people and to get out there and get ahead. And that's fine, I guess. But I don't think that's the long-term way to approach it. You know, the long-term, yeah, the most innovative firms I have seen are the best at leveraging the technology that already exists rather than building it themselves. Yeah. I've seen very few firms be successful at actually building technology and that being the long-term most successful solution for them. In fact, the opposite. I've seen multiple times where they build stuff and ultimately have to bin it because they actually can't hang on to the developers that originally built it. They never really think about the ongoing costs. You know, you think about, okay, well, it'll cost us X amount to build it up front and it'll take us 12 months. Great. But what about the next 5 years of constant evolution of that product and maintenance and, you know, investing it? That, because that's what a product company does. They have a whole team and their whole reason of being is to build and improve and, you know, keep evolving their product. So it's really difficult, kind of contradicting what we said earlier on. It is difficult building software, right? It isn't easy. And it's not easy for a company that isn't fully focused on doing that. In direct answer to your question, I do think at the moment, yes, there is need for, you know, quite technical people to really understand the products that are out there and the products and the solutions and the different productized or commoditized versions of Gen AI that are starting to emerge are all different and you're going to need to understand them and how to apply them. But I think over time, that need will probably decrease as the use cases become more clear, as the product becomes, you know, more mature, more tailored to those use cases and everything evolves. But for now, yeah, I think it's complex. It's a combination of people that understand the processes and the problems that you're trying to solve and they deeply understand them, mixed with people that are technical enough to be able to take the right technology and, you know, working in concert with those other people to apply the technology in the right way to solve the problems. It is a blend of technical and kind of you know, domain expertise, if you like.
Yeah, makes sense. So we're going to wrap up shortly, but I think that Stu Raz would probably kill me all the way from Australia if I didn't give you the chance just to sort of say a bit more about Syncly. You've obviously talked about Syncly a little bit, but tell us a little about Syncly and where you are.
Yeah.
What you're trying to solve for.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, actually, before I talk about Syncly, you know, I will just give a shout out to the guys at Legatics as well. So, you know, I've sat on the board of Legatics for the last 3 years and, you know, much like we've talked about, that's a, you know, a tool for, you know, solving transaction management, really, and, you know, trying to improve the processes. You know, it's very much in line with the sorts of things we've just discussed, you know, trying to improve the way people work and applied specifically to transactional matters. And with Syncly, the premise is similar. We're actually trying to solve, I think, a really simple problem, which is how do you move your data around and how do you keep, you know, your data in the right place and make sure it's secure and, you know, that you've got control of it and that it isn't where it shouldn't be. So, you know, in a nutshell, Syncly enables you to connect up multiple systems. You know, for example, I manage your net documents to things like HiQ or Opus 2. And you can, you know, connect your documents and data and move it around either as a kind of a one-off or as an ongoing synchronization. And that's the kind of the base use case. But actually, perhaps arguably the most interesting bit is it also enables you to kind of archive your data at the end of a transaction. Okay. So let's say you put a load of data up into HiQ, and then you at the end of the day, you need to ultimately close that down. What we found, you know, as you all know, at HiQ over the years, is people are really good at putting data into systems. They're not very good at taking data out of systems. So it can get a little bit out of hand sometimes. And, you know, from an information security perspective, from a risk perspective, that isn't usually a good thing. So it also helps you get your data out of these systems and make sure you are compliant with whatever your kind of internal and client, you know, based policies are. So yeah, syncing data, moving it around, being compliant, reducing risk, and making sure you have full control of your data at all times.
I think we've just ticked off the Syncly bingo card of value prop there. Well done. Congratulations. Cool. Stu, it's always good to chat. I think, as you said at the beginning, I think we spent nearly 10 years working together, which is probably why I'm grey, but you were already bald, so I can't be blamed for that. So, you know,
I'm also much greyer than I was before I met you, Ben.
Well, it's probably AJ's fault. Let's blame AJ.
I blame him. He's also more grey, so, you know, perhaps we're all to blame.
Yeah. But thank you very much for your time, buddy. We'll catch you soon.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.
Cheers, bud.
Cheers.